Call the Senate Finance meeting to order. It's 1:32 in the afternoon. We have with me Co-Chair Stedman, Senator Bishop, Senator Wilson, Senator Keel, Senator Merrick. Senator Hoffman's in the area, but is busy doing other Senate work. I want to acknowledge those legislators that are in the room. We have Senator Matt Klayman, former Senator Jerry Mackey, and I think that's it. Today we have two bills on the agenda, Senate Bill 127 by Senator Klayman and Senate Bill 88 by Senator Giesel. This is the first hearing for Senate Bill 127, Vehicle Rental Networks and Tax. Senator Klayman, can you please come on up with up to the table with your staffer? And this is your first hearing. Go ahead and introduce the bill and introduce your staffer as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, this is Senator Matt Klayman. I represent District H in West Anchorage. Thank you for hearing Senate Bill 127. Senate Bill 127 was introduced by my office at the request of the Department of Revenue. Senate Bill 127 requires vehicle rental platform companies such as Turo and Getaround to collect the existing state vehicle rental tax and remit the tax to the Department of Revenue. Additionally, Senate Bill 127 revises the subpoena provisions that relate to Department of Revenue tax collections. The department informed our office that vehicle rental owners who rent through peer-to-peer car sharing networks owe the vehicle rental tax under existing law, but the law requires a new section to specify that the vehicle platform company, which doesn't own the car, are responsible for collecting and remitting the tax. Historically, the Department of Revenue has tried to go after vehicle rental platform companies to collect and remit the tax from the vehicle owners, as their application has the capability to do so. The vehicle rental platform companies have not been cooperative in enabling the tax collection feature in their application. More than 3 years ago, due to their lack of cooperation, the Department of Revenue began seeking remittance from the vehicle owners themselves, who are liable for the tax under the existing state statute, to ensure that vehicle rental platforms like Turo and Getaround are responsible for collection purposes. The statute requires an amendment, hence our decision to introduce legislation at the request of the Department of Revenue. I will note that in 2020, the municipality of Anchorage, facing similar challenges, adopted similar legislation requiring the vehicle rental platform company to collect and remit the city's 8% vehicle rental tax. Discounting the impacts of COVID-19 on rentals in 2020, the vehicle tax revenue to the municipality of Anchorage has increased substantially in the years since the adoption of that ordinance. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to my staff, Carly Dennis, to explain the details of the bill.
Ms. Dennis, please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Carly Dennis, and I am staff to Senator Klayman. Section 1 of this bill amends AS 4305040C by removing unnecessary language regarding the issuance of out-of-state subpoenas related to tax records. Section 2 amends AS 4352050A by adding language clarifying that vehicle rental platform companies and other companies that arrange vehicle rentals and leases shall collect the existing state vehicle tax and remit the tax to the Department of Revenue. It also adds language requiring vehicle rental platforms collecting the vehicle rental tax to pay the tax quarterly. Section 3 amends AS 4352050 by creating a new subsection C requiring a vehicle rental platform that arranged or executed more than 200 transactions in the state in the preceding calendar year to collect and pay to the department the taxes imposed under AS 4352010 through 4352099. Section 3 also creates a new subsection D, clarifying that a vehicle rental platform company is not liable for failing to collect or pay the vehicle rental tax if they were provided with incorrect or insufficient information. The company must demonstrate that a reasonable effort was made to obtain the correct or sufficient information from the person. Subsections C and D were added at the suggestion of Turo representatives. Section 3 also adds a new section E, defining motor vehicle, vehicle rental platform, and vehicle rental platform company. Section 4 amends uncodified law by adding a new section related to assessment and collection limitation. The Department of Revenue shall have 6 months from the effective date of this act to assess and collect the vehicle rental taxes that were imposed before the effective date of this act on a transaction arranged or executed through a vehicle rental platform. If the tax is not assessed and collected before 6 months of the effective date, after the effective date of this act, proceedings may not be instituted in court for the assessment or collection of the tax. And finally, Section 5 provides an immediate effective date. That concludes our sectional analysis, and I'll note for the committee that the Department of Revenue has prepared a presentation on this topic, and we'd ask that they be able to present before we go to questions.
Before you leave, do you have any questions by members of the committee for the bill sponsor or staffer? No, thank you very much for coming up this afternoon. Deputy Commissioner Fidel Lamani, please come on up and give us the perspective from the Department of Revenue.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Fidel Lamani, Deputy Commissioner for Department of Revenue. Also, I have online our Acting Tax Director, Brandon Spanos, who is available to help with answering any questions the committee may have. Looking at this proposed legislation, the primary objective of this legislation is essentially to move the responsibility for collecting and remitting the tax from the individual owners to the vehicle platform companies. I want to make it very clear that this does not impose a new tax. The tax already exists, and so not does this legislation provide a streamlined process for the administrative aspect of Department of Revenue, but it creates compliance and reporting as well. In this light, I want to call two statutory provisions to your attention, one being AS 4352-00, which provides that there's an imposed exercise tax on the charge for the lease or rental of a passenger vehicle in the state if the lease or rental of the passenger vehicle does not exceed a period of 90 consecutive days. And then number two is AS 4352-050, which provides that taxes shall be collected and paid to the department by the person who provides the leased or rental vehicle. Moving to slide four, essentially the bottom line is that the tax burden already exists under 4352-010. So what this bill does, it enables the and compels the vehicle rental platforms to collect the tax at the point of sale and also remit the tax on behalf of the vehicle owners. Slide number five provides a little bit of background about the excise tax as it pertains to the vehicle rental tax. Alaska levies an excise tax on fees and costs charged for the lease or rent of a passenger or recreational vehicle if the lease or rental does not exceed a period of 90 consecutive days. Looking at the rates for the different passenger vehicles, the rate is 10% of the total fees and costs for renting or leasing. And for recreational vehicles, the rate is 3% of the total fees and costs. Vehicle rental and agencies are required to submit and file with the Department of Revenue quarterly tax returns. As it pertains to the legislative history on slide six, the legislature enacted the vehicle rental tax back in 2003. And it became effective as of 2004. Over the years, the legislature has exempted a variety of different types of vehicles, and most notably and recently in 2020, the municipality of Anchorage passed an administrative ordinance, AO 2020-55, which essentially established the duties and responsibilities of the rental car hosting platforms. As a result of doing that, the municipality of Anchorage has reported in excess of $7 million in revenues. Slide number seven provides for the legal framework. We covered the first two provisions. The last two provisions is the statutory obligations that the Attorney General and the Department of Revenue have. So first, under AS 4423.020, item 2, the Attorney General shall bring, prosecute, and defend all necessary and proper actions in the name of the state for the collection of revenue. And number 2, under AS 4425.020, 1 and 2, the Department of Revenue shall 1, enforce the tax laws of the state. Number two, collect, account for, and have custody, invest, and manage the state funds and revenues of the state, with the exception of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. Looking at the new IRS regulations, as part of the American Rescue Plan Act of 2021, the IRS passed new regulations that basically changed the threshold for the third-party network transactions, which is also commonly known as Form 1099-K, to $600, regardless of the number of transactions. Historically, that threshold had been more than 20,000 or more than 200 transactions in a particular year. And so the IRS has been delaying that implementation, essentially is doing a phased in. And in November of 2023, it expressed that as for tax year 2024, that's being reduced to $5,000, regardless of the number of transactions. And then for 2025, it's going to be to $600.
I'm sorry. Senator Wilson. Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Deputy Commissioner. I know this is a lot of legalese speak of things, but I just wonder if we can help simplify this for the public and folks watching, because a lot of folks, I don't think, understand the implication of what this bill is trying to do. This is really, you know, for folks, the Toro bill is sometimes what this is referenced. And when you're talking about third-party network transactions, you're talking Venmo? Are you talking other actions? So if you can help explain this to people, because I think a lot of folks don't really understand this may apply to them.
Mr. Lamani.
Certainly. Through the chair. Senator, the Form 1099-K, basically it's an IRS form. Prior to 2012, if anyone participated on a network transaction that was in excess of $600, the IRS required that you were either issued a 1099 miscellaneous form. After 2012, the IRS imposed a new regulation that basically said you're required to submit a Form 1099-K if you participated in sales for consumption of goods in a network transactions like Venmo or any other platform, that you are required to pay the tax. And that was for 20,000, but more than 200 transactions. And so recently, as part of the American Rescue Plan, the IRS has changed that regulation, that threshold, to essentially go back to the $600 provision, and it's doing it in a phased implementation. And so the reason why it's important for the purposes of this is that currently, the Department of Revenue does not have the ability to get accessible data as it pertains to the vehicle sharing platforms. And so once these regulations go into effect where these thresholds are being reduced, the Department of Revenue Tax Division is going to have complete records of who's participating in these different platforms, which means at that point in time, we'll have to assess the tax and collect. Hopefully that provides some context on
it. Senator Wilson, Senator Bishop.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you have any estimates on ballpark on leakage or revenues going uncollected? What drove this?
Mr. Lamani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Bishop, I appreciate the question. Because of the limited information that we have, we don't have firm numbers as to what the fiscal impact is going to be. By implementing this legislation, we believe that it's going to be a positive revenue for the state. Currently, what we have on the books is outstanding tax is about $500,000 that we're in arrears from different across 25 different taxpayers. As of today, based on the assessment that we have within the tax division and the knowledge that we have, We believe that there's about 80 participants that partake in the platform. We recognize that it's a very conservative number, and in reality, it's higher than that. And of that 80, 4 taxpayers are voluntarily reporting their tax returns and filing that with the Department of Revenue.
Thank you.
Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Olson. Is there any concern that Turo or a light company is going to pass this tax on to the folks renting the vehicles?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
Is there any concern that, you know, you're having Turo pay the tax, that Turo will pass that on to the people that rent vehicles for them? Is this going to cost people that do Turo as a business? Is it going to come out of their earnings?
Mr. Lamani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Merrick, it's not a new tax. So essentially, rather than the obligation and the tax responsibility being at the owner that's leasing the vehicle, what is going to happen is that the platform is going to collect the tax on their behalf. So there's a parity. There's no new tax.
Thank you.
Follow up, Senator Merrick? Follow up? No?
Yes, I'll follow
up. Okay, sure.
Is there any concern that a rideshare company would just pull out of Alaska if they're required to pay this?
Through the chair, Senator Merrick, I'm not sure. We haven't had those conversations with the platforms in terms of what kind of an impact it's going to have to them. But essentially, they're passing the tax to the user, so there's no fiscal impact to them directly.
Thank you.
Senator Wilson.
Yeah, thank you. And I guess that was my next question, Senator Merrick asked. I was going to wait to the next slide. But there would be an impact because there would be an admin rate for Turo to collect that tax. And so that admin rate probably will be passed on to the user renting. But have we heard from any of these, companies in terms of opposition or feedback to the bill? Maybe that's the bill sponsor. Might be able to answer that when he comes back up, or if you know any sort of feedback from any of these companies.
I think that's more of a question that we should be asked of the sponsor rather than the department.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Answer the question if you have the answer.
Senator Wilson, we can't speak to that. I believe they are here present that also going to provide their testimony. So maybe that question will be best fitted for them.
Go ahead with the presentation.
Slide number 9 basically encapsulates the fiscal impacts, which I basically talked about. Over the last 4 years, the annual revenues that we've been collecting as it pertains to the vehicle rental tax is average about $10.7 million. Again, we don't have an assessment of what the revenue impact would be as it pertains to this legislation. We believe that it's going to have a positive impact. And again, as far as the delinquency that we have is $470,000 across 25 taxpayers.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you. And I've been contacted by a couple of these taxpayers in terms of the Department of Revenue's aggressive collection efforts. What is the department doing now in terms of these taxpayers and maybe future taxpayers that you may find that may owe before this piece of legislation may be passed?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, the Department of Revenue hasn't taken any active actions. At one point in time, the Department of Revenue did, through the tax division, didn't send notices to these individuals, but there hasn't been any recent actions.
I guess, Mr. Chair, if I could follow up.
Go ahead.
Is the department looking to take action against these payers eventually, or just going to forgive this debt or wait till this piece of legislation pass and with some of the other provisions go after the network companies? I'm just trying to understand. I think they want to have a better understanding of what the Department of Revenue's actions may be against them in a future date or if any.
Mr. Lamani.
Thank you, Senator Wilson. I mean, as is discussed in some of the statutory provisions, we have the obligation to collect the tax.
Thank you.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Deputy Commissioner, on that point, what is this bill a more efficient way, cost-efficient way for you to collect this tax, or would it be more cost-efficient to have the department contacting, as Senator Wilson described, contacting individual taxpayers, tracking people down based on the IRS forms you're going to start getting? What's the better bang for the buck?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, this would in fact provide more efficiency on the Department of Revenue. We don't have necessarily the staffing levels to be able to identify within the different platforms as to how many vehicle owners exist. So we require a lot of due diligence in that regard. So by being able to have it hosted in under one platform, it will certainly make that a lot easier and feasible for Department of Revenue.
If I may, Mr. Chairman. So kind of the flip side of that question goes to the efficiency of the small business, for the small business person, or maybe the ease. So I have my brother-in-law, may he rest in peace, for a couple of years rented out a car using one of these platforms. One guy, one car. I assume, of course, that he was one of the ones who voluntarily registered with the department. But let's imagine for a moment that maybe not. Which is going to be for that just Alaskan who wants to get a couple extra bucks off a vehicle they happen to have, more efficient for them, easier for them with this bill or with whatever process you'd put in place if the bill doesn't pass?
Mr. Lamani.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, we believe that with this legislation, that will certainly make it a lot easier on the individual vehicle owners.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Is that the end of your presentation, Mr. Lamani?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much for coming up this afternoon. Do we have any further questions for Mr. Lamani by members of the committee? Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Olson. It's my day. Are there other states that collect tax this way?
Through the chair, yes.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, we'll go on to invited testimony. Oh, sorry, Senator Hoffman.
Are there other states that have a different tax structure than what's here today?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, across the U.S., there's different kinds of structure that take place as it pertains to the ride-sharing platforms. It varies by state. There's some that are relatively consistent as to what we're doing here in Alaska, but there's also states that do it differently. They have different rates, different provisions on their requirements, but it's kind of across the board.
As a follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Please.
Is there an underlying reason why they have the different structures or rates? What's their underlying justification for having different rates?
Mr. Lamani.
Through the chair, I don't know that I can speak on behalf of other states in terms of why they may have different rates. Like I said, again, it varies by each individual state. What we're looking at is what's already in statute here is the 10%, so there's no change to the rate.
Follow-up, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions by members of the committee? Mr. Lamani. Okay, we've got two people that are up here to testify or online to go ahead and testify. The first is Greg Gilbert with a Midnight Sun car rental. Are you on, Mr. Gilbert?
Yes, sir, I'm on.
We can barely hear you.
Can you hear me, sir? Yes, sir, I'm on the call.
Okay, go ahead with your testimony, please.
My name is Greg Juber. I'm with the business of Midnight Sun Car and Van Rentals here in Anchorage, and we're located on Bernard Road, about a mile away from the airport. And I would like to encourage you to support and pass this bill, Senate Bill 127. The car rental tax was implemented, like they mentioned, the gentleman said, years back in 2003. The tax that we happily pay, and we invite car ride share programs into the market. We're happy to have them here. There's a great abundance of need for car rental companies and car rental cars in the summertime. We're just asking for fairness, that other individuals who are renting their vehicle out using these platforms pay the same taxes that we have the joy of paying ourselves. We pay 10% to the state of Alaska, 8% to the city of Anchorage. And in the summertime, there's an abundance of individuals renting their cars, and we're happy to have them do so. But for them to ignore the taxes that are supposed to be collected and due to the state and to the city is not, sort of, lack of a better word, fair. And we just encourage that the Senate and the legislature enforces the rules that are already on the book. And I'm sure there's lots of other individuals and agencies that would be happy to use the funds that be collected to as needed. And that's what I'd like to say about that.
Thank you very much for coming out this afternoon, Mr. Joubert. Next, we have Benjamin Palmer with Enterprise Rental Car. Mr. Palmer, are you on, sir?
I am. Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the opportunity to express the support for SB 127. Benjamin Palmer, Director of Government and Public Affairs for Enterprise Mobility. We're a privately held, family-owned company with Enterprise Alma National Brands. We've been operating in Alaska proudly since 1989. Recruit recent college grads, pay taxes, find ways to give back to the community where we can, and very happy to be here in Alaska. As you know, the issue may be familiar to you, and I know you've had a robust discussion. We see it just simply clarifies that the platforms have to collect and remit the existing tax on behalf of the car owners, taxes paid by the renter, something that all customers in the state of Alaska expect when they rent a car. I think importantly, as was emphasized earlier, SB 127 doesn't impose a new tax. As stated in the fiscal note, it simply moves the responsibility for collecting, remitting from the individual owner to the vehicle rental platform company. Collect on revenue and no additional cost to the Department of Revenue for the slides we saw. So happy to answer any questions and, you know, appreciate the opportunity to express our support.
Do we have any questions for Mr. Palmer or members of the committee? If not, I want to thank you for coming out this afternoon and testifying on this bill. The plan is to go ahead and set the bill aside. We'll see it the next time it's scheduled. Thank you. Taking at ease. call the Senate Finance meeting back to order. Next bill up is Senate Bill 88, which has to do with retirement system benefits, defined benefits in particular. This is the seventh hearing for this bill. Last time we heard the bill, we adopted the committee substitute version T. Today we're to hear from the administration, answer some of the committee's questions, and then to see the will of the committee. I'd like to invite to the table those people with the department or the Division of Retirement and Benefits, Mr. Worley, Mr. DeJay, and whoever else you want to bring up. Okay, come on in. Please identify yourself for the record so we know who to be asking, and all we know is that you're with the Division of Retirement and Benefits. Start with the lady first.
Good afternoon, Chair, and the members of the committee. My name is Ajay Desai, Division Director for Retirement and Benefits. Joining with me.
Good afternoon. For the record, Kevin Worley, Chief Financial Officer for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. And also online, we have David Kirshner with Buck, our consulting actuary for the administration.
Okay. And I'm Kathy Lead, the Chief Pension Officer for the Division of Retirement and Benefits.
Okay. Certainly this bill has created a fair amount of intensity, part of it because of the size of the fiscal note and the fiscal issues that we're dealing with and the people's that are affected by it. And so thank you for coming in and making time out of your busy schedule on short notice to go ahead and come on and answer some questions. And we do have some questions that are there. We'll start out with Senator Stedman.
Okay. I need some help with the fiscal note. That's one thing that we think we need to cover this afternoon, and some bucks. But a precursor to that, I need help understanding how the unfunded liability that we have accrued. We owe about $6.8 billion, and we cap it at 22% at the local level at the cities, and the state takes on anything over 22%. And we use the entire payroll at the of the entities in calculating that. And just for a little bit of background, we capped that at 22%. The legislature did to get the attention of the communities, but not to the point where they're going to go bankrupt. Because years ago under the old system, they would have went bankrupt, most likely, led by Fairbanks. So I'm not sure how the calculation of that unfunded liability plays in the event that the new bill that is proposed goes underfunded, and particularly underfunded over 10%, so it slips under the 90 trigger. So the rates for the employee and the employer would both increase, is my understanding of the bill. How that plays into the amount paid by the state over the 22%, and that margin of increase for the employer when they jack that up, how does that play into the part that the state takes over? So, on a more direct way, I'm curious and want to find out if they can do liability shifting from the local level to the state in the event that this fund goes underwater.
Senator Stedman, do you have a person you want to individually want to address that to, or you want to just go straight to the director and have him decide who's going to answer?
We'll start with the guy in the middle, and then he can ask for help, I guess. I don't know who to exactly ask that question to.
Director Desai.
Would like to direct this question answered by David, our actuary from Buck. Can provide the answer more in detail and the components, how the cost analysis is done for the unfunded liability. David?
All right. Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, you're coming in loud and clear, sir.
All right, good afternoon. My name is David Kirshner.
I'm an actuary with Buck Global LLC, and we work with the Division of Retirement and Benefits and the Alaska Retirement Management Board, affectionately known as the ARM Board, we perform actuarial calculations and projections for the state's retirement systems and help the ARM Board in setting the contribution rates that are used to fund the benefits. The funding of PERS and TERS, the Public Employee Retirement System and the Teachers Retirement System, is pretty complicated. And when you get into a fiscal note like we have with SB 88, there are a lot of moving parts that we have to consider. As Senator Stedman said, by statute, every PERS employer contributes 22% of pay to the defined benefit and the defined retirement contribution plans, the DB and the DR, DB and the defined DCR plans, excuse me. And then every TERS employer contributes 12.56% of pay, again, to the TERS DB and the TERS DCR plan. A portion of the 22% or 12.56% goes first toward the DCR plans to fund the occupational death and disability, the retiree medical benefits, the employer defined contribution, the fixed contribution, which is 5% for PERS and 7% for TERS. And then there's also a 3% health reimbursement arrangement or account contribution. When we determine the contribution rates, we first subtract off the contribution rates that are going toward the DCR plans. And then we compare the actuarially determined contribution rate for the DB plans. And the difference between what's remaining from the 22% or 12.56% versus the actuarial rate is contributed by the state via additional state contributions. Now, there is one caveat under Senate Bill 55 that was passed a couple of years ago. The state, under PERS, pays the entire actuarial rate, not just the 22%, relative to the compensation of its employees. So the additional state contribution for PERS applies only to the non-state employees, and the additional state contribution for TERS applies to the entire population. Under SB 88, there are a few things going on. One basic thing that we have to keep in mind when we consider SB 88 is that the benefits that would be provided to the people who would come into the DB plan and all future hires would enter the DB plans rather than the DCR plans. Those benefits are what we would call richer benefits, providing a defined benefit lifetime pension is a richer benefit than providing a fixed percentage of pay contribution, and which is what happens under a defined contribution arrangement. We also have to factor with the defined benefit plan that employees can retire under certain conditions earlier than normal retirement date if they have sufficient service. For example, PERS, peace officers and firefighters can retire with 20 years of service, and other PERS employees can retire at any age with 25 years of service. And similarly in TERS, TERS teachers can retire with roughly 25 years of service. So when we are calculating the costs associated with the defined benefit plan versus the defined contribution plan, we have to factor in those different levels of richness of benefits. The other thing that has to be considered is when we're doing a calculation to determine a contribution rate or doing actuarial projections into the future, we have to project what we expect changes in the population to occur over time. People who are currently retired, either they're the retired employee or their beneficiary is receiving a lifetime pension, we have to estimate how long we expect that to be paid based on life expectancies using our standard mortality tables. For active employees that are not yet retired, we have to project what's the likelihood that an active employee today will be around and still be employed and retire from active service to receive a pension from the defined benefit pension plan. And there are a number for active employees we have to factor in. Termination, we know that not everyone is going to remain employed because some are going to terminate every year. Some are going to retire. Some are going to stay working. Some might become disabled, and some might die. So we have to project those populations. We use a series of assumptions, both economic and demographic assumptions, to make the projections of what those future benefits are going to be and how long we expect them to be paid. And then we determine, once we have our projected benefit stream, we then determine the liabilities associated with those projected benefit streams. For people who are in the defined benefit plan, we have a set of retirement assumptions and a set of termination assumptions. And then we similarly have, for the people who are in the defined contribution retirement plan, we have a set of retirement assumptions and termination assumptions. Those assumptions between the two groups are not the same, and it makes sense if you think about it, because there's more incentive for people covered by a defined benefit plan to remain employed so that they can receive their benefit, as opposed to a defined contribution plan. There tends to be higher turnover because there's less incentive to stick around when all you're getting is a defined contribution from the employer. And in fact, one of the intended goals and purposes of SB 88 is to help improve the attraction and retention of employees. And I think it's fairly agreed by everyone involved that if the employees that are currently under the DCR plans are covered by the defined benefit plans, we would expect to have higher retention, which leads to lower training costs and lower turnover and all the other economic benefits that the state would realize by higher retention. So we have to factor that in our calculations. So one of the questions that has come up is, why do we have projected payroll different before SB 88 and after SB 88? Well, there's a couple of reasons. One is we take everyone's current salary and we project it based on salary increase assumptions that the ARM board has adopted, and we help them set those assumptions based on actual plan experience that we look at every 4 years. The salary increase assumptions are the same between those covered by PERS DB and PERS DCR, but they're slightly different between TERS DB and TERS DCR. So that's one difference. The second difference is, when we project our population going forward, currently under the DB plan, before SB 88, all of the future hires are going to enter the DCR plan and be subject to the DCR termination rates and retirement rates, versus after SB 88, all of those future hires are now going to be in the DB plan and therefore subject to the DB assumptions regarding turnover and retirement. So we have two different projected streams of people, whether they're covered by a defined benefit plan or a defined contribution plan. And that is, again, consistent with the overall purpose of one of the goals of SB 88 is to help with that retention and attraction of employees. So that's sort of a basic overview of how we determine the funding. I'd be happy to answer any specific questions regarding our calculations.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kirshner. Before we go on, I'd like to go ahead and recognize that we have one of the senators in here, Bill Wilkowski, who's come on up and joined us in the gallery. Senator, we have a follow-up by Senator Steadman.
Well, I didn't hear the answer to the question. We owe roughly, so let me rephrase it, we owe roughly $6.8 billion in an unfunded liability from the past, and we're working through that. When we adopt this legislation, and in the event that it goes underfunded, maybe it goes down underfunded 15% or some number, so the contribution rates increase both for the employer and employee. The question is, how does it affect the unfunded liability that we're currently having, where the cities are capped at 22%? And does the city then have the ability to, or other members that are non-state, to shift a portion of that liability that we're paying now onto the state? In other words, when their contribution goes up 2%, and we're stuck on everything over 22%, do we end up having a bigger call in the Treasury because we have some of that liability pushed over to the state?
Mr. Kirshner.
Through the chair, Senator Steadman, I apologize for not addressing your specific question. The current unfunded liability that exists in PERS and TERS would not be affected by SB 88. And as you said, there are provisions within SB 88 that would increase the employer contribution and the employee contributions and cut back on some of the cost of living adjustments that are paid by the plan if the SB 88, the funded status of the SB 88 portion of the trust falls below a certain level. Our fiscal note analysis from May of 2023 assumed that all future experience would match our valuation assumptions, which means that we're not projecting any adverse experience that would trigger some of those SB 88 provisions. So we didn't ignore those provisions, but they didn't kick in because our financial status of the trust going forward is not affected, which would then lead to some of those benefit provisions being triggered. Now, in terms of your question about whether the cities or municipalities can contribute more than the 22%, that's a statutory issue. Right now, the statutes say that every PERS employer other than the state of Alaska within PERS pays 22% of pay. And unless the statutes would be changed in that regard, my understanding is there would be no ability for any of the participating employers, the cities or municipalities, to be able to transfer any of their high contributions as a result of SB 88. So SB 88 doesn't affect the existing unfunded liabilities of the PERS DB and TERS DB, but SB 88 does affect future contribution rates. And as those contribution rates are already above the 22% and the 12.56 for TERS. So any increase in those total contribution rates, actuarially determined contribution rates, would then fall to the state, not the employers, because the employers are capped at the 22% and 12.56%.
Mr. Kirshner, I think that the biggest fear we have here at the Finance Committee is that we're going to get ourselves into a situation like we did during the last DB program. It was out there about 10 or 15 years ago, and it was changed to the DC retirement plan. How do we make sure we're not going to get into that trap again?
Through the chair, well, that's a very good question. That's that's an important consideration for the legislature to consider as they're debating SB 88. As you mentioned, back in 2006, when the defined benefit plans were closed to new entrants, one of the benefits that the state received from that action was shifting the risk of future investment returns from the state to the participating employees. In a defined contribution plan, the employers contribute a fixed amount, and then the individual employees invest that as however they choose, and then whatever they're left with when they retire in their account, that's what they have to retire with. In a defined benefit plan, on the other hand, you're guaranteeing an annual benefit based on a formula and final, you know, compensation and years of service, and that's going to be paid to the participant and the beneficiary for their lifetime. And in a defined benefit plan arrangement like you would have with SB 88 reopening the defined benefit plan, that investment risk would come back to the state just like you had that investment risk prior to 2006. And we make this point in our May 11th, 2023 fiscal note letter that says by shifting active members and all future hires from the DCR plans to the DB plans, the state will be taking on greater risk of larger unfunded liabilities in the future and higher contribution rates in the future. Now, some of that risk will be mitigated by some of the levers that are within the SB 88, but the rest of the group, the unfunded liabilities for all members, are subject to the 22% and 12.56. So by reopening the defined benefit plans under SB 88, the state would now be taking on some of the risk that it transferred back in 2006 when it closed the DB plans.
Follow up, Senator Simon.
No, I just would like to reference page 4 and 5 of that physical note of May 11th on line 7, and maybe I garbled up the question a little bit. The concern is we don't have opening a door for the municipalities to shift more of the current liability onto us because we take everything over 22%. They're capped. We can do that. But I have some other questions, but I'll have other people ask some questions.
Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Wilson. How much of our current unfunded liability was a result of the medical portion of the plan?
Mr. Kirshner.
Through the chair, Senator Merrick, the healthcare portion of both PERS and TERS is actually overfunded. We've had the last few years, we've had some favorable experience in terms of the claims, medical claims, and prescription drugs claims that are paid out. So, as of 6/30/23. The PERS Healthcare Trust is about $2 billion overfunded, and the TERS Healthcare Trust is about $800 million overfunded. The problem is that overfunding of the Healthcare Trust cannot be used to help pay down the underfunding of the pension trusts because they're legally separate funds.
Senator,
now, I'm speaking as an actuary expressing a legal opinion, but I just want to confirm I am not a lawyer, but our understanding, we've explored that with the ARM board a few times, and our understanding is that there is no way to tap into the overfunded assets in the healthcare trust to help pay down the underfunding of the pension trusts.
Thank you.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you. And my question is going to dovetail to Senator Merrick's question. On when you ran your first sort of actuarial assessments, were you under the understanding at that time that the additional health trust overpayments would go into this new tier under SB 88?
Mr. Kirshner.
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, no, the contributions going in to the SBDA trust for the SBDA tier would be the actuarial rate, but no less than 12%, which includes 3% for the HRA contribution. So we're not, we did not incorporate any overfunding of the healthcare trust in our SBDA cost analysis.
Just follow up, Senator Wilson.
Yeah, just on another note, on would you say a 90% funded pension plan is a funded pension plan?
Mr. Kirshner.
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, a funded pension plan is 100% funded. I mean, there are degrees of funding, whether it's 80% or 90%, but our goal is to have enough money in the fund to pay all promised benefits. And in that respect, we need 100% funding.
Just one last follow-up.
Senator Wilson, please.
Under this bill, what is a 90% liability, or I guess it'd be a 90% funded a pension plan? What's the liability to the state of Alaska in dollars? Guesstimate.
Mr. Kirshner.
Through the chair, I'm sorry, Senator Wilson, could you clarify which of the existing pension plan?
No, under SB 88, this plan, what would a 90% pension plan, what would that liability be to the state of Alaska if it was only funded at 90%?
Mr. Kirshner.
The unfunded portion.
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to follow up with that information. I don't have that information at my fingertips right now.
Okay. Senator Stedman, another question?
Yeah, help me again. My understanding is there's an updated fiscal note or a updated actuarial analysis being done. Is that correct or incorrect?
Mr. Kirshner.
Through the chair, we were requested by Chiron and Flick Fornia, who are two actuaries working with the bill sponsors, to provide some alternative projection figures with different assumptions. The May 2023 fiscal note assumed that all existing defined contribution retirement active members would elect to transfer to the DB plans under SBDA, and then all future hires would enter the DB plan. And they have asked us to provide alternative, for example, assume 0% of the current actives elect to transfer, and then assume only actives over age 50 or the over 10 years of service elect to transfer. So we are in the process of running those additional calculations, but that has not been completed yet.
Mr. Kirshner, when do you expect them to be completed?
Well, we're currently preparing materials for the March ARM board meeting. So our goal is to have these additional scenarios completed by the end of February.
Okay, thank you. Senator Stedman.
I'm just struggling here trying to figure out, because we've got dueling actuaries, we've got these fiscal notes. What do we use for the fiscal note? We should be able to, we're dealing with 100,000 people, I think. We should be able to put a finer point on it. I don't know what documents to rely on.
If the division will go ahead and back to this, we'll have Ken Alper and the bill sponsor come on up and try and get to the bottom of the question, bottom of the answer.
The department should be able to help us, I think.
Director Desai, you can stay there if you want. If you think you have an answer, or can contribute to it.
Sure.
So, Mr. Alper, what What is the situation that he asked for? He asked a few minutes ago about what the next process is because of the multiple fiscal notes as well as the multiple actuarials that are out there. Some are dated and some are there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Ken Alper, staff to Senator Olson on the Finance Committee. To Senator Stedman's question, there are three current fiscal notes part of Senate Bill 88 at this point. One of them is, I'll call it a conventional fiscal note, the administrative costs for Director Desai's division to implement the changes, work with the employees to figure out the value of their funds so that they could buy surface and a new DB plan, that sort of thing. That plan, that note was updated with the new fiscal year. We received it about a week ago, and I would expect, should this bill move from committee, it would be updated again to the new bill, relatively straightforward, and would travel with the bill to the next committee, to the Rules Committee. The other two fiscal notes are fundamentally different. They are attached to the Buck actuarial analysis that came to the committee in May. One of them talking about, I feel like I've lost sound, one of them being the state costs for state employees, the other one being the costs of where the state pays above the 22%, 12.5%, 6% for municipal and school district employees, but they're two sides of the same coin. They're both tied to the actuarial analysis. They are current and they will be updated as part of the normal practice of moving a bill to the next committee. The concern is that these are big lifts for the actuaries and for the analysts. So what we've been told is it would take a month to 6 weeks to get that analysis. In practical terms, this isn't the final version of the bill. The actual analysis isn't going to change that much. The quantitative work done in this committee, the changes to the bill are relatively minor as far as the impacts of the bill. So the decision will be made by the Senate, as I understand it. If they want to put this bill on the floor, we'll likely need to generate our own fiscal note based on the Chiron actuarial data and attach it to the bill. And then when the Buck actuarial information is updated and a fiscal note can be updated based on that, it'll sort of catch up to the bill in the other body.
Mr. Alper, if I heard you right, you said there's a current fiscal note and an updated fiscal note. How can you have an updated fiscal note and a current fiscal note that aren't the same? Maybe I misunderstood what you said.
I might not have spoken clearly. Setting aside for a minute the regular agency fiscal note, sure, which is under normal parameters, the fiscal notes attached to the actuary are dated May 2023. They're actually written to the previous committee, to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee's version of the bill that you received back in early May. That will be updated per statute and normal rules once this committee moves the bill. But again, because of the nature of the analysis, it's expected to take over a month. In the interest of moving the bill through the process and giving it a chance, the committee would be drafting our own fiscal note with the assistance of the committee's own actuary. So that would be the updated fiscal note, and then there would be a subsequent update over in the other body once the once Buck's analysis was updated.
Senator Diesel, you want to add to that?
Not really, Mr. Chairman. We have Mr. Desai here from R&B. And
I was going to call on him next, so if you don't have anything, we'll call
They're
on
They're the folks that prepare our fiscal notes, sir.
Mr. Desai, please identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
For the record, my name is Ajay Desai, Division Director for the Retirement and Benefits. And as David also mentioned from Actuary, we are trying as best as we can to produce the updated fiscal note with the latest information, with any changes that occurs within the bill. With the other priorities, as mentioned earlier with the ARM board, we have competing priorities, but we will try to comply as soon as possible and work with Mr. Alper to provide those information.
Thank you very much for your efforts. Senator Stedman.
So this 1.56 or 1.589, I guess that's a billion, whatever it is. Is that the cost of this thing?
Through the chair.
Please, Director Desai.
Senator, statement, the 1.6 is the administrative, the retirement and benefits cost. That has been changed a little bit from the last year, which includes personal services, travel, commodities, and other costs. That adds up to about 1.6 for fiscal year 2025.
1.6 what? Dollars or?
1.616, that is 1.6 million.
Okay. Senator Stenman, that answer your question?
One of them, just trying to figure out what you know what the costs are. So what? So we're going to have the department's going to update their analysis, and how long will that take? Do you think to get to the back to the committee?
Department can also update. Division can update. Our fiscal note will verify these numbers. We have recently done that. We will re-verify those numbers. That should not significantly change, but we do assume that if there would be any changes, it would be very minor. And we will, as soon as we complete that analysis, we will submit those information to the office.
And the total fiscal note cost?
Senator Al Ark, Ken Valper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The fiscal note that the director and Senator Stedman are talking about is the one that I referred to a few minutes ago as the conventional fiscal note. This is the administrative cost of the bill that I'm certain they will update very quickly, because it's a normal analysis of the staff cost of administering the program. The ones that we need to find a potential alternate method temporarily are the ones that are tied to the actuarial analysis. That would be the potential cost of additional payroll and pension contributions from the state and from the state on behalf of municipalities tied to the overall labor force. That's the one that Mr. Kirshner mentioned won't be available for a number of weeks.
Okay.
But the 1.6 million is a regular fiscal note that I expect will travel with the bill to the Rules Committee.
Can we get ballpark numbers, Mr. Chairman? I mean, are we looking at $100 or $200 or $10,000 or $10 million?
Mr. Chairman, the two fiscal notes that were tied to the Buck analysis, and I talked about this some in my remarks yesterday, add up to a sum total of about $1.2 billion over 16, 17 years, of which about $140 million is in the first 6 years, which is the period covered by the fiscal note. And again, that most of that money is not additional costs specific to Senate Bill 88, but rather under the assumption that, as Mr. Kirshner described, the retention would be improved and therefore the state payroll would get larger, the additional costs of providing benefits to a larger state payroll with more higher paid employees in it.
Senator Bishop.
I'd just like to qualify that comment just a little bit more, that $250 million difference in payroll, that's fill in the vacant positions that's in the budget now, that's unfilled if this bill was to pass. Is that how we get to that number?
Mr. Alper.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, there is a very large vacancy rate, and my expectation is there would be a lower vacancy rate. I don't know precisely how much of that is budgeted, but roughly speaking, I would tend to agree with your comment.
Thank you.
Senator Giesel.
Mr. Chairman, I would also like to see quantified the savings in recruitment costs and retraining costs for new employees incorporated into an analysis. Clearly, that would reduce the overall cost.
Society, do you understand what we're asking for? Are you able to provide that information?
Sure, yes, we do.
Okay, thank you very much. Senator Stedman.
Another question. This is for the department. You know, I think we have somewhere like 110,000 employees or some number in the total defined contribution plan. When we convert it to the defined benefit plan, there'll be a calculation to see if they're over or underfunded, you know, if they have a catch-up for their benefit structure, what have you. When can those numbers be delivered to the legislature?
Mr.
So we can get an idea of
who's over and who's under and what magnitude we're dealing with?
Mr. Sasek, do you understand the question?
Through the chair, as I understood, I believe that will take some time. As David from Buck mentioned, actuarial work will take some time, and we are targeting to get that done before probably end of the February.
I think, Mr. Desai, I think we're not looking for a precise number. We're looking for a number that's fairly accurate, though. So I don't think you have to go to lengths to go ahead and try and get the precise number. Is that correct, Mr. Senator Stedman?
No, I just...
Okay. Follow-up, Senator Stedman? Senator Kiesel? Senator Keel?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I just wanted to actually don't have a question, but I wanted to applaud the division. I look back and the cost of implementing this new tier, when you inflation adjust, is almost spot on, same as implementing the defined contribution tier. Some 16 years ago, maybe more now, coming up on 18, despite a little more complexity in the conversion. So I appreciate the sharp pencils at DRB.
Okay. Thank Comment, you. Mr. Desai?
Yes, through the chair. One of the reasons that this cost seems a little conservative compared to the cost that we did about 22 years ago, or 16, 17 years ago, that we are also anticipating the implementation of the new system. So we have considered that the immediate cost might be a little bit higher, but the eventual cost after a year or two might dilute due to the implementation of the new system, and that might help us greatly.
Okay. Further questions from members of the committee? Senator Stedman?
No
questions? Mr. Morley, would you like to come on up and make some comments on what you think of the bill, what you think we're going with it? Since you're with the division, I'll ask the same of Ms. Lee as well. Ms. Lee. There have been a number of questions that have been pointing toward the division, obviously, and there's a fair amount of responsibility with some numbers there that... we'd like to have answers for, and it's obviously going to take some time. We're under that understanding. We want to make sure we're all on the same sheet of paper and that we're singing the same song as well. So do you have any comments you want to make on the legislation and on what the division's view of the legislation is?
Certainly. Kevin Worley, Chief Financial Officer for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. Regarding fiscal note, for implementation of 88. We have brought forward on May 13th the letter from Buck. Initially, it showed a reduction in fiscal year 25 of $905,000. Starting in 26, we saw an increase of $11.7 million, increasing up through $21.4 million in 2029. So after that presentation, we met with Chiron and Flick Fornia, and they wanted to look at some different scenarios within the analysis that Buck had done. Based on what we saw yesterday, what Mr. Alper had provided, and through the presentation that Chiron had done, Chiron had indicated on their slide number 7 that the analysis done by Buck was
arithmetically.
Math was good.
Okay.
Yeah, the math was good. And it reflected the benefit of cost associated with increased retention, which was expected with 88. And then Mr. Alper kindly pointed out that, you know, if we were showing the high end of the bill and then if it didn't meet the retentions, the cost wouldn't be incurred. And so what we've talked with Buck on is again, updating the estimate for the fiscal note using 23 data. We've just completed the draft of the June 30, 23 data, which shows a investment rate of return just over 7%, which is in line with, you know, what the actuarial rate of return is. We expect to see some better numbers as a result of that. And I'm guessing here, based on the presentation that was done yesterday, that maybe some of the data requests that we had from Chiron and from Flickfornia may not be necessary if we're in more of alignment based on the issue of the math being correct. So if we can get rid of some of this additional data requests, Buck could start working on the information a lot sooner on the fiscal note.
We'll talk with this bill sponsor and then kind of fine tune specifically what we need.
I think that would be fantastic. To the chair, Kevin Worley, chief financial officer. I think that would be good. If we're, again, you know, the issue that we experienced in May last year was, it was called dueling actuaries. Right now, we seem to be more in line in terms of the numbers since the math is good, that maybe we can bypass some of these added requests and then move straight into doing the data analysis for the fiscal note. Because it is a lot of additional information that's being requested.
Sure.
So a lot of additional work that Buck is devoting to providing that data, but taken away from doing the fiscal note analysis.
Okay. Ms. Lee, please give us your perspective or closing comments, whatever you want to do.
To the chair, this is Kathy Lee, Chief Pension Officer for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. Determining whether the math is good is Mr. Worley's job. My job is delivering the benefits when they're passed. So from that perspective, we can deliver what you're looking at delivering.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Stedman.
I have a question for her, Mr. Chairman. So at the previous meeting, we talked about this bill, and there was concerns expressed by some people, including myself, that it doesn't fix the TERS gap. And that gap meaning they're not in Social Security, school teachers, or supplemental benefit system in the state, leaving about a quarter of the retirement off the table. This bill doesn't fix that. So the problem still exists. What does TERS have to do to get into or be allowed into the supplemental benefit system so they could be on par with other state employees? And for those watching at home, it's a huge difference. A state employee gets roughly about 25% contributions between them and their employer to the retirement system, where a school teacher gets 15. It's a huge gap. There's no way they could catch up. So how do we get TERS, the TERS into SBS, knowing that the Social Security's got this offset, so it's kind of a poison pill?
Ms. Lee.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, the SBS statutes themselves would have to be amended in order to allow TERS to participate. Right now, it states only public employees may participate. And I reviewed some material today that the divisions received that indicates that it is possible for TERS to get into SBS if those statutes are amended.
Senator Stedman.
Yes, I'd like to have her meet with my office to do an amendment on another piece of legislation to have that discussion at the table.
SB 200?
What's that?
SB 200. Sure. Okay, any further comments?
No, sir.
Okay, it certainly is a concern that we have been talking about for a number of years. With that, you have any closing comments? Any further questions by members of the committee for either the division or for the bill sponsor or Mr. Alper, or the committee?
We have a brief at ease.
Oh, sure. Let's call the Senate Finance Committee back to order. For some closing comments, we'll ask the bill sponsor to come on up and give us some closing comments, please. Thank you very much for coming in, Division Director.
Yes,
Mr. Worley, Ms. Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Kathy Giesel. I represent the Senate District E in Anchorage. That's E as an echo. Mr. Chairman, thank you and members of the committee for hearing this bill again. I know that it is complicated, but many of you have been here for a very long time and were here actually when the defined benefit system was changed to defined contribution. I don't know how many of you who supported that defined contribution switch actually moved your retirement off of the legacy DB to the DC. But in any case, I would point to Professor Teresa Ghilardushi, the professor that spoke yesterday, the economist. And on the first page of her testimony, she points out that switching to the defined benefit plan is projected to save $76 million per year. I have been asked how much the change in the medical benefits will benefit this new defined benefit plan. That is, if the person retires before they're Medicare eligible, there's no health coverage in there. They have the medical savings account, which they can use to continue their state insurance if they'd like to buy into that, or they can go out to the marketplace. But the medical benefits don't kick in until as a supplement to Medicare. So there is cost savings there. Mr. Chairman, I want to talk about, just briefly, you know, for every bill, there's a question to answer. Why is this bill being offered? Mr. Chairman, the state of Alaska is dealing with tremendous shortages in core services. You can look out that window and experience what Anchorage has been experiencing. Snow plowing challenges. We have a shortage of operators for the heavy equipment. Welders, mechanics, these are basic things. We have schools with shortages of teachers. We have firefighters constantly being moving out of state for better benefits, higher pay. It is true, the discussion at the table yesterday about wages, that's an important piece. But historically, people have gone into public service not for the paycheck, but for their heart wanting to serve the public, number one, but also knowing that at the end of the day, they have a solid pension and they will be able to retire without all the anxiety of potential poverty. This is particularly important, Mr. Chairman. The data shows it that women are the most vulnerable to retirement poverty. If we look at the gender of the folks providing education for our children, we're talking about women. Huge part of our public service workforce is women, and they face that significant risk of retirement poverty. I also want to remind the committee, I love the conversation about SBS and Social Security. That's great. And maybe another bill to open SBS up, open to teachers, that'd be great. But, you know, remember the reason that Alaska opted out of Social Security is because we had a great pension to offer. And so it was felt, well, this would be a savings, right? Not to have to have that additional fee. What we have right now, Mr. Chairman, in a defined contribution plan has its problems as well. And some of you may be aware of what was discovered by the ARM Board, that's the Alaska Retirement Management Board, last October. And that was that the Empower organization, the company hired to manage the defined contribution funds, was not managing them appropriately. I'm trying to find the correct words. I don't want to vilify them. And yet, on the other hand, it was discovered because one of the ARM Board members pressed the question, why are the fees so high and the earnings so low? And it turns out Callan did an audit. And this is the actual document presented to the ARM board on October 13th, was it? Yes, October 12th, 2023. That said, the performance record of these managed accounts show that investors utilizing the managed account services for all their assets materially trail the performance of investors in the age equivalent target date fund. Now that's relevant, Mr. Chairman, because Empower was automatically enrolling the DC members. I'm one of them, perhaps some of you are, automatically putting them into these managed accounts, where the investments were not being made appropriately to maximize earnings, and the fees were five times what they should have been. The ARM board passed a resolution at that meeting saying, we want this to stop. And apparently that's been executed. They're no longer automatically. But Mr. Chairman, this is exactly why we need to keep looking at these and improving our retirement plans. And going to defined benefit, you heard Buck, Mr. Kowalski, saying that this will be an answer for recruitment and retention. And that's my whole goal here, Mr. Chairman, is a functional state government so that our families, our businesses, and our communities can count on that stability and a more prosperous economy here. Thank you for hearing the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Giesel, thank you very much for your comments this afternoon. We have a motion. Oh, Senator Keel.
If I may, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Senate Finance Committee report out committee substitute for Senate Bill 88 Finance, version 33 LS0505/T, as in Tokiak, from the committee with individual recommendations, the attached actuarial report, and the attached and forthcoming fiscal notes.
Yeah, brief at ease.
At ease. The finance meeting back to order. I'm sorry I failed to recognize that we had former Representative Chuck Kopp in the audience. He's been here during the whole hearing, and we have a Representative Stapp in the back as well, watching the festivities that we're having this afternoon. We have a motion on the table. Is there any objection to moving the bill? Okay. By a vote of or not in a vote, by unanimous consent, we will send this bill to the next committee of referral. I'm sorry, Senator Wilson.
By unanimous consent, just no objection.
Okay, no objection. Sorry. We'll go ahead and call on IDs to sign the committee bill, sign the committee report. Finance Committee back to order. This concludes our agenda for today. Tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, Senator Stedman will be sharing. We'll be hearing additional testimony from the Legislative Finance Division on the governor's budget. There's no other business to come before the committee. We're adjourned at 3:10 p.m.